Good afternoon. How are we doing on the sound in the back? Can you hear fine? Excellent. I am going to say a few words and then give you a short form lecture. I know that calling something a lecture usually sends people running in the other direction, so I marvel at your attendance and thank you for coming. But this lecture has a sort of history. Wilbur Kotz was a professor and dean at the law school. Did anybody here know Wilbur Kotz? Well, then I can't exaggerate too much. But of the many things that Wilbur Kotz is known for, the one that I always like best is that he saw the World War coming. And he said to students at the law school, there's a war coming, you're going to have to go fight in the war, so why don't you take extra classes now, and that way when you come back you can graduate on schedule. And I like that idea of looking ahead and bending the rules and violating all the ABA norms about law school and everything of the sort. And you run into people from the Wilbur Kotz era who went through law school in 6 or 7 weeks or something of the sort. I believe me, I only exaggerate a little bit. So I think we should always think of Wilbur Kotz as somebody who taught us to bend the rules in order to move legal science forward, so to speak. So in that spirit, I thought that we would honor him this time with a talk on a regulatory subject. You know what it is from the poster. It's about the future, or the supposed future, of obesity regulation. And I'm going to leave plenty of time for questions so you can get your questions ready, but I have a thesis to put out for you. And our law school record, which I hope you read carefully, did slightly prematurely publish a piece on this that I wrote. So following the great lead that Richard Epstein sets for me every day, I will only agree with 50% of what I wrote. So that, you know, half of it will be, if you've read that, half of it will agree with that, and half of it will be exactly the opposite, and that way you'll have to stay on the edge of your seat. So here's the idea. Let me tell you my larger thesis, and then we'll get down to a little bit of detail, and then again, it'll be your turn, and we can flesh it out with some questions. The larger picture is something like this. I want to compare obesity and smoking and college scholarships and retirement savings. I'll pick those four topics. There are many, many other topics to put in the mix, but that's enough. I want to sort of focus on those four topics, and obviously more on obesity than the others because that was the title and that seems to be in the news lately. And for all those things and many more, my thesis is going to be something like this. It's a thesis with one complexity. The thesis is that we need to think of our government, aside from all the ways we're taught to think about it, there's a new way to think of our government, and it is, when we say government of the people, by the people, for the people, what we mean is it is a government of self-control. That we look in the mirror and we see some things about ourselves. That's not quite an obesity joke yet. I'll try to stay away from those. But we look in the mirror and we see some things about ourselves that we wish were different. And we know that we will regret them. We watch other people and we see that there's regret. And then we might think, you know, I would like to plan ahead so that I am not regretful later on. How can I do that? And then you might enlist government on your side. And that's the thesis that I'm going to flesh out. The complexity to the thesis is that it is easier and harder to do these things depending on how interest groups are aligned. Sometimes it's very, very difficult to do that, and I'll give an example of that, and sometimes it's very easy. Let me give you an example of where it's easy so that you can see where I'm heading. Think about retirement plans. They're very interesting surveys of people at almost every age, starting at about age 45. If you interview people at age 85 and you say to them, do you wish you had saved more during your working years? More than 90% of 85-year-olds say yes. If you ask them when they're 75, about 85% of them say yes. If you ask them when they're 45, about 65% of people say yes. There are very, very few living people who wish they had saved less money. I mean, it's actually very interesting. Many people will say, I'm doing about right. But almost everybody will say, I wish I had saved more money. So that's a good example. Then people might think, well, I see that I will wish that I had saved more money, my alternative self. How can I go about saving money? Well, I can tell you to shoot me if I don't save money. I mean, there are a lot of things you could do. But one obvious thing you could do is enlist the government. And you could go to the government or go to your representative and have the government pass legislation that makes it easier for you to save money, so to speak, gives you tax benefits to save money, or tells you that if you put money in an IRA account, you'll be penalized if you take it out. I mean, these can all be seen as methods of self-control. And that's going to be my thesis, basically. Again, as for the complexity, if you advance that cause, if you go to Washington and you say, help me save more money, you have a lot of help, because all these Wall Street firms will see you as a great target, and they'll say, that's a great idea, making people save more money. Why encourage them to put it in IRA accounts that we'll manage, or the following kind of retirement plans, or whatever, or it has to be run through an intermediary, sort of like Social Security reform. And indeed, there are interest groups that would rather you save less. Right, there might be car companies might prefer that you spent more money on a car today, and they might think that if you saved more, you'd be less likely to buy a car, and they want to sell you more cars. But there are many, many, many such dispersed interests out there, and so there are thousands of interests that each care a little bit about getting you to spend more money, but much better concentrated organized interests that would like you to save more money through these devices. So the interest group idea aligns pretty well with self-control. Okay, that's going to be my thesis. I'd feel better if you'd nod your head that you get it. And then I can proceed. I did promise one of my favorite graduates, who's in the audience today, but whom I won't identify, that I would not talk as quickly as most professors at the law school speak, I believe were his exact words. So I'm trying very hard to speak clearly and slowly, though it does not come naturally. So please tell me if I'm going a little bit too fast. All right, now let's do smoking and obesity, and then we'll get to college scholarships, a subject close to my heart. So let's first do smoking. Smoking is obesity 40 years ago, right? I mean, where we are today with obesity is where we were with smoking in about 1960 or 1964. So the evidence about smoking was mounting. In case you haven't heard, smoking is not good for you. It probably, if you smoke a pack a day, your life expectancy drops by 6 years. 6 years is a lot. If you value lives at a few million dollars, which is how we do it in tort suits these days, or in air regulation, or whatever, if you multiply 6 years times a few million dollars a year and divide that by a pack a day, it means that, you know, the cost to you, so to speak, every time you buy a pack of cigarettes, you should probably think of that pack as costing not the $5 or so that they charge you for it at the local store, but you should think of it as costing $40. Throw in another $35 for the life expectancy cost. That's throwing in some of the diseases associated with it. There's probably a little bit more, not to mention dry cleaning bills and things like that. Now again, if you're a person who has no self-control problems, you don't need a tax of $35 on that pack. After all, you will feel those costs. You'll feel them when you're sick, you'll feel them when you die early, you'll feel them when you bring your clothes to the dry cleaning. The tax would only be necessary if you're the sort of person who has trouble planning ahead. If you're like most of us, you have trouble with self-control and you want to think, well, how can I make myself see when I buy that pack of cigarettes that that pack is really costly to me in many ways? You might want to go to the government and say, do me a favor and don't let me have that pack without a $35 surcharge. That will drive home to me the cost of the cigarettes. I suppose, by the way, if you want to be very law and economics about it, and you do, then if you buy the pack anyway, and you get sick anyway, and you go to the dry cleaners anyway, and you die young anyway, I suppose that when you're on your deathbed, you should say to the government, by the way, it didn't work. You charged me $35 a pack in taxes trying to help me with self-control. It didn't work. I bought the cigarettes anyway, and now I've also had all these health costs worth $35, so you kind of double charged me. I would now like back all my money. Problem, of course, is if the government gives you back your money and you know you're going to get the money back, then you'll go buy the cigarettes earlier in time, figuring, hey, it's savings. You could kill two birds with one stone. Buy the cigarettes, pay the $35, then when you're old, the government will give you all the money back. So that won't work. So you might need the money to go to a third party or something, but we'll worry about that another time if anybody dares to ask about it. Sometimes this is called, I think very clever, not an externality tax, like we might charge a polluter money for polluting the river, but an internality tax, right? It's trying to drive home to me what it is I'm doing, and I might need that drive because I suffer from self-control problems. Most of us suffer from self-control problems. I think we understand that idea about why money might help a little bit. By the way, cigarettes are extremely sensitive to prices, despite some of what you read. You raise those taxes. If that cigarette box went up from $5 to $40, there would probably be, you know, very, very few teenagers in America who would go buy cigarettes. That is, who would pay an older person to go buy cigarettes for them. That would be very, very expensive. Even raising the price from $4 to $5 cut consumption of cigarettes by 15 or 20%. I mean, it's really quite an elastic good. So the tax would probably make a big difference. Again, there is an interest group that doesn't like it, cigarette companies, and that's partly why that form of self-control was slow to come about. And we know why it came about. The threat of secondhand smoke really spurred cigarette regulation enormously. All of a sudden, it began to be not just that you need self-control, so how much will I help you do that in the face of tobacco companies, but all of a sudden, non-smokers felt threatened by smokers, and there's a whole story in there. Well, let's turn to obesity for a minute, and then I will try to show you something else about that. Oh, by the way, smoking, same thing. If you ask 75-year-old people who smoke, do you wish you didn't smoke? It's very, very hard to find anybody who says, I'm happy I smoke. It's kind of an interesting self-control feature. There are very few things like this, by the way. If you go to people who are addicted to various kind of drugs or addicted to material goods or who drive fast or who travel a lot and you ask them, do you regret this? They go, no, I love this. They like stamp collecting. They like coin collecting. People like almost everything they do. Normal psychological reaction is to rationalize and like the person you are. You know, I like having no hair. I do. I'm not kidding. I've actually convinced myself that I like being this person. I like wearing eyeglasses, I would tell a survey, thinking I'm telling the truth. Oh, it gives me protection when someone hits me. I mean, my brain has convinced itself of that. You know, people don't say that about smoking, about obesity, and about savings, and a few other things. So we should really take that evidence quite seriously. So let's review obesity a little bit, and then see where it takes us. So severe morbid obesity, I don't know if I'm the only one here. Do people follow these things? Like, how many people would know their body mass index? You don't have to raise your hand. Just nod your head, because I don't want to embarrass you. Yeah, you would know that sort of thing. Well, if your body mass index, it used to be thought that a body mass index of 27 or 28 was acceptable, and then the government, in its wonderful manner, suddenly decreased it and said, now it should be 25. 25 means that basically everybody we know is obese. And they have a headline say, all of America obese, or two-thirds of Americans obese. You know, so it depends how you measure these things. But a body mass index of 35, let's say, that's really pretty heavy. A body mass index of 40, that's very, very heavy. That would be, you know, if I weighed 300 pounds, I would have a body mass index of about 40. That's really quite heavy. That's only about 3 to 4% of Americans are that heavy. And that's so-called morbid obesity. At that obesity level, that's like smoking a pack a day. Okay, so that's exactly like, that's a six-year loss of life expectancy. Interestingly enough, most of the loss of life expectancy occurs in the later years. If I weigh 300 pounds, it's very, very unlikely that I would die in the next couple of years. But it is much more likely that I would die, say, at age 81 rather than 84 or 89 or something of the sort. That's important to understand because that's why health insurance doesn't seem to care very much about obesity, unlike smoking or hang gliding or a bunch of other things, because very few of our health insurers think that they will still be doing business with us 15 or 25 years later, right? It's usually through a place of employment, people switch jobs or retire and so forth. So it's really Medicare and Medicaid that cares about obesity. So if I gain 100 pounds, you should be nervous because it's going to show up in your taxes. My University of Chicago health plan doesn't really care that much about that, which is probably a bad thing. As we'll see. Anyway, so the internal costs of my getting that big are very, very expensive. By the way, a body mass index of 35, which would be if I weighed about, I think it's 256 pounds. It was pretty big, but there are now lots of people with body mass index of 35. That's a little more modest. That's 2 to 4 year life expectancy. Still pretty substantial. Less than that is really not very exciting. I mean, you know, what most of us would regard as quite overweight has very, very modest life expectancy effects. It has a few other healthcare effects, but mostly it's severe obesity that is associated with very, very serious costs and self-control problems, at least according to current health statistics. Now, it's thought to be a problem. I'm going to rush through evidence because you can read this elsewhere. You know, are we having a crisis? I don't know. You can judge the evidence as well as I. There certainly is much more obesity than there used to be. Say if we just stick to morbid obesity, 4% may not seem like a lot. Just a decade ago, it was 1.5%. So this is really rather substantial sudden increase. Same with child obesity, same with teenage obesity, same with severe as opposed to morbid obesity. So there's reason for nervousness that all of a sudden there's dramatically more obesity. The best evidence is that this has to do with sedentary lifestyles. It has to do with the rise of snack food. Note the interest groups there, people selling us snacks. There are about 20,000 new food products introduced in the market every year. It's a little bit like movies or CDs. 20,000 are introduced, maybe 200 or 300 take off and make a lot of money, and then the manufacturers go back and try to find more forms of potato chips and juice and other things that we'll like. And I recognize I say all this with cookies in front of me. Please, have one. Yeah. No, I have two. Go ahead. You've paid for it already. What's the difference? Just go. I mean, that is the way the food is thrown at us and the lack of exercise and so forth. Sometimes the headlines say this is just an American problem. That's not true, but it's very interesting. So Finland, Slovakia, Czech Republic, Poland, these countries, they are chasing us for the obesity crown, especially for males. So there are many, many countries in which obesity is a rising problem. Interestingly enough, there are a few countries where it does not appear to be a problem. Japan is one of them. Parts of France, or ethnic groups in France, let's count France as not having an obesity problem. Those are interesting countries because they have very high tariffs on food. So interestingly enough, Japan and France, this is one of the few times in my life when I feel like competition is a bad thing. It seems like if you can avoid competition in the food industry, everybody pays higher prices, so to speak. That seems to be a good way to prevent obesity for the country as a whole because you don't have hundreds of companies pushing fast food at people. And so forth. But for most of us who like competition, that's not an option, and obesity therefore appears to be an international problem. There are other explanations. By the way, let's just go through a few things that you're thinking. You might think, well, obesity is really an equilibrium thing. If I lose weight, the evidence is that I'll go back to my old weight. Indeed, there's a school of thought that says that everyone is hardwired with an equilibrium rate, equilibrium weight. There's nothing you can do about it. You weigh what you are, so to speak. That might be true for many people, but as we see, obesity statistics have increased. So that cannot be true universally. Another way to think about it is maybe obesity is an addiction. I think that I am addicted to food, for example, just to share with you a little bit. I think I am addicted to food. I mean, I can feel my brain thinking about it constantly. So maybe the way to think about it is, well, how do we feel about other addictions? And the answer to those addictions is that we never seem to have one method of solving the problem. If you have a drug addiction or an alcohol addiction, then as is well known, it might be that hypnosis works for you and drugs work for you and therapy works for you and nothing works for you. And, you know, each plan seems to work for 4 to 5% of the people with the addiction. It's a very, very hard health problem for the country as a whole. And that may be what we'll find out obesity. That is, it might be very, very expensive. But for some percentage of people, money can solve the problem. Again, like cigarettes, there is evidence that if you charge people enough for food or you tax them enough for being heavy, that will affect many people's ability. Making food cheap does make people eat more. So maybe the question is, well, will the government respond as it did with smoking? Will the government regulate obesity? Maybe it'll weigh us all on Plymouth Court as we exit from the building and then charge us if we gained weight and reward us if we lose weight. There are many things the government could do. Unsurprisingly, because of the law school that I work at, I'm here to say no. There will not be government regulation in the future. But I think the reason is that even though the self-control in us might want that regulation, even though we should predict regulation in the form of self-control, as there is for smoking, as there is for retirement savings, as there is in a minute, I'll argue, for college scholarships, I think the interest groups are aligned the wrong way. The food manufacturers, the diet industry, the exercise industry, all those industries want us to eat more. Indeed, it's very hard to find an industry that would be behind obesity regulation. And the general evidence from our regulatory pattern is that although it is a government of the self-control, by the self-control, for the self-control, that's only true when our self-control aligns well with interest groups. So I don't think that's going to happen. I do think, if you've read anything I've written about this, I won't go into that here, then you know that I think the future is more likely to be in private arrangements. We might have employers who come up with arrangements for groups of 1,000 people, let's say, where you get rewards if you don't gain weight, or you pay extra costs to your employer if you do gain weight. I think there's some hope for that. I would enter such an arrangement. If when I came to the University of Chicago, the university said to me, pay an extra $2,000 every year, we'll deduct $2,000 from your salary, and then we'll give you a $200 prize every month if you stick to certain health goals, in order to try to drive home to you that you'll be wealthier, so to speak, if you're healthier, I think I probably would have gone along with it. I would have liked that, actually. I know I need help, and I would have been willing to take on the help. I notice the skinny people in the audience giggling, but that's okay. We have a problem. We're happy to deal with it, and that's okay. So I do think the private sector will rise in this, but I will leave that for the question period. Let me say a word about college scholarships. If you're skeptical and suspicious about all this way of thinking about regulation, let me point out college scholarships to you. So think about smoking, obesity, retirement, college scholarships. What all these have in common is that you would not think for a minute that we needed any government regulation. These are all areas where the individual has a very, very strong incentive to do the right or healthy thing, so to speak. Right? I have enormous gains from not smoking. I have enormous gains from not becoming severely obese. I have enormous gains from going to college and occasionally doing my homework and maybe being lucky enough to go to graduate school and get a good job and be inspired by interesting teachers. Note the little plug for the law school there. And and retirement, there's every evidence that older people wish they had saved more money and then they could travel and do other things and give it away to the University of Chicago Law School, note the plug there, and so forth. Well, why are we regulating those areas? Again, because of the self-control problem. Those are all areas where, despite the strong individual incentive, even the libertarian gene in us realizes that, left to our own devices, most of us will not do a good enough job, or not do a job that's as good as the one that we wish to see. College scholarships are an astonishing example of this. There's no investment as good as going to college. And yet, the government is out there giving people money to go to college, giving colleges money, encouraging people to take loans to go to college. There's a part of us that should say, this is crazy. Why is the government taking money from rich and poor people, but often from poor people, in order to give it to people to send them to college when going to college is good for them? But of course, the answer is that even though it's good for them, people don't do it. And it's good for the society as a whole, as well as for the individuals, to go to college. So again, think of it as a self-control system. That's exactly what I'm suggesting about obesity. So I almost defy the person who thinks that government support of college scholarships is a good idea, but obesity regulation is a bad idea. It's very, very hard to put those two things together. They are both about this self-control idea. So again, I'll just make a prediction. I think it fits the self-control scheme, but not the interest group scheme. I do not think we will see a lot of obesity regulation in the future. We could do it. We could design it. We could avoid moral hazards, a subject I'm sure somebody will raise in a moment in questions. But I don't think we will do that because the interest groups are incorrectly aligned. I do think that we will see a growth of health insurance, employer, maybe other community sort of based private contracts where we essentially enter into bets with one another in order to try to maintain a healthier lifestyle. It's traditional when you give a talk to try to finish with something inspirational. And what can be inspirational about, you know, our fear of looking in the mirror and realizing we're going to die 6 years earlier and people are going to snicker at us while we do it. And so I don't have anything inspirational to say, except to say, look, let's get over that. Let's recognize that a good deal of what we do as a government, a good deal of what we are as a citizenry, is we are a government of self-control. It may not be inspiring, but that's who we are. And I think we should be comfortable with that and then think about our regulatory apparatus accordingly. So, please ask some questions, and then we'll see where we are. Yeah. I will repeat the questions because I know it can be difficult to hear here. If the questions are not very good to my liking, I'll refashion them.
Let me start by giving you permission to refashion this question any way you like.
Thank you.
So the question is, first a quick comment. In regard to the people who say that they wish they had saved more, what they really mean is they wish they had more money because they were making choices as to, for example, I got to pay the tuition to send my kid to law school, and I can't afford to put that money away. But the other point has to do with your issue about obesity and comparing it to smoking and the interest groups. There is an interest group, the people who don't like the secondhand smoke, and we've seen a lot of that in Chicago, but not necessarily the tobacco industry or the health industry is not complaining about it. And I think the same thing with obesity. People get on an airplane who really shouldn't be sitting in a coach seat, who really should have to buy two seats. People sit in a theater, and they're taking up a seat and pouring over into the aisle. And I'm just wondering whether those kinds of decisions by the private sector as to what they want to do to give comfort to their patrons are not really more in keeping with the University of Chicago's ideas of free will and liberty as opposed to government regulation, as opposed to saying, okay, the government's got to make a decision. Are we going to tell people who are fat that they shouldn't eat because they enjoy eating, or smoking cigarettes because they enjoy cigarettes?
And where are you on college scholarships, by the way?
I think that it's just fine.
You let the government support those?
I don't really care for the government getting involved in almost anything.
Yeah. Okay. So first, let me say, we have many students here today, so I have witnesses. I just first want to express my own political views. I am not a normative kind of guy. I am not telling the government what it ought to do. I'm not telling you what you ought to do. I am just a positivist. I am just trying to predict the future of regulation. I, you know, believe that from the bottom of my heart. I do have occasional normative views about things. Like, I think you and I should support the University of Chicago Law School. I believe that. But there aren't that many. I do not believe that you and I should murder, well, most people. I mean, I have some normative views. But 99% of what I'm saying, I just mean it as a predictive matter. What does our government do? What do we learn from our legal system? Given what the government's likely to do, can we nudge it a few directions to make things a little less harmful or a little better and so forth? So with that said, well, I understand there is this libertarian streak, but again, I'm just trying to predict government regulation. The fact is that, but I agree with your secondhand smoke thing, and now I will restate the question for those who didn't hear it. The basic question was, well, I understand smoking regulation because of the threat of secondhand smoke. Maybe that's really the only excuse for regulating obesity and the like. That is, there are obese people who get on airplanes, who are in theater seats, who interfere a little bit, and maybe that's the way to think about it, because what people want to do with their own lives, that should be their problem. The government should stay out of it. Again, I'm not in what the government should do. I agree with you about smoking. That is, I want to emphasize that. The self-control argument for smoking did not really predict as much regulation as we have now. It did require the secondhand smoke scare, so to speak. And that did really move the population in the direction of much more in the way of bans on smoking. I think that although it's inconvenient to have an obese person next to you on an airplane and so forth, I think most of us would think that's a relatively small externality compared to the smoking effect. Another way to think about that is you're not about to pay a subsidy to the skinny person who sits next to you. And why not? I mean, they're giving you more space. So, you know, that's usually a pretty good check. You might pay for clean air. But, you know, most people, you know, it's not that big a problem. There are ways of avoiding it and so forth. But I agree with you, it's a little bit of an issue. In any event, that's a steady state problem. Whatever inconvenience it is from having obesity next to you in the theater, that's relatively steady state, though there are more obese people getting next to you in the theater. Whereas the secondhand smoke is a good live experiment because it was a quantum leap that all of a sudden secondhand smoke was found to have some scientific evidence as being bad for you. And my prediction was that that had to do with spurring. I did say that before that study as well, that that would spur a lot of regulation. Again, since we agree on most of this, I would just say encourage you to think about college scholarships, retirement plans, and the like. It's not a matter of banning. I'm not banning you from buying a Ferrari. I'm using subtle methods of encouraging you to save a little more rather than to buy a Ferrari. There might be a value added or a luxury tax on the Ferrari in some generations. There might be tax breaks from savings and so forth. It's really subtle mechanisms that the government can use to try to move you in one direction or the other. But again, it's only a prediction about where the path will go. I'm very eager also for people in the back to feel like they can ask questions, because there are many hands. So I'm going to alternate, if that's okay. You'll be next, but there we go.
You raised the point with the scholarships. I guess you were thinking of some of the self-control issue. At least rhetorically, one of the reasons that politicians get support for certain things is an intergenerational idea that, you know, a child who's born with a poor family, didn't have a good education, should have a chance to, you know, go to college, get a good education, and go on from there. And so I guess the passion argument for college scholarships is there's not just a self-control issue, deciding what the person to go to college, it's also sort of protecting the children a little bit, not fully aligned incentives between parents and children, it's just about the environment where they support rather than actually. How is it, you agree with that, how would that affect the argument of obesity as it relates to children?
Yes. That's really a terrific question, which I'm going to restate. And I like the double twist in the middle. That's really a very good question. Not that yours wasn't good as well. But that was really very good. So the question, to repeat the whole thing, is essentially this. Is that, well, wait a minute. College scholarships are thought to be good, not just because of self-control, but because of an intergenerational feature that we think, well, especially people from lower-income families might not go to college, and it's good to encourage them to go to college. There's a little bit of a parent-child or societal intergenerational shift. And doesn't that inform us, though it's not clear how, doesn't that inform us about obesity? Because part of the obesity problem is about juvenile obesity, when, again, we might have different views about the self-control issue. And, again, it might be either how do we influence parents to care about their children's health, or how do we offset parental neglect or something of the sort. So let me first defend the not quite metaphor of the college scholarships. I am, as you know, normatively a big fan of scholarships. We give lots of financial aid to people who go to law school, and I don't think it's entirely about self-control. But I'm going to stick to my guns here. You know, the government could lend people money to go to college and only lend money, right? The government could say to universities, if you want financing from us, that's fine, but following the libertarian ideal, going to college is demonstrably a good investment. And it's not just a good investment if you major in biology or computer science. It's even a good investment if you major in anthropology. You know, that's a good investment. That's a dramatically good investment, about 18% a year. For most people who go to college. So it's not a good investment for everybody, nothing is, but on average, the high school graduate thinking of going to college or not, it's a good investment to go to college. It's a good investment to go to a fancy college. It's a good investment to go to a community college. It's a good investment to go to a four-year college rather than a community college. Every step of the way, it's a really good investment, much better than you can get in a hedge fund. I mean, it's really quite impressive. So why give people money to do that? We might want to educate them. We might want to lend the money to do it if they don't have the cash flow to do it. But giving the money to people to do what's good for them, that's what I'm calling a self-control problem. That it's not just this rhetoric of, oh, they don't have money, they need help. We can lend them the money to do it. Capital money. We don't give people money to open 7-Elevens. You know, that really helps poor people. Go be an entrepreneur. But we say, well, if you have a business idea, that's a good thing. That's great. We like you to be an entrepreneur in your low-income neighborhood, we will try to make sure that banks aren't discriminating against you, and so we lend them money in order to make money. It would never occur to us to give the money away just because a poor person opening a 7-Eleven really gave us a good feel or was good for the society. So that's what I mean by the self-control issue, that we must think that even with full information, people will not go to college as much as they will wish they had gone to college, and so forth. So I think I'm going to stick with that idea. And I don't think you'll disagree with it, actually. Now, the juvenile obesity is a very, very interesting issue. Part of the problem is it's very hard to give incentives to kids that we would not find insulting or offensive, right? I mean, you can't pay people to lose weight because the obvious reason that every Chicago grad knows, I mean, people will then gain weight in order to get the money to lose weight. I mean, that's a terrible problem, and some of them won't succeed. You can't give their parents money to get them to lose weight, or the parents will hit them in order to get them to gain weight, in order to get me, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on. It's very, very tricky. But it can be done. There are subtle things we do. We do just fine getting parents to get their kids to get vaccinated. There are therefore some health steps we could probably take with parents and children as well. But I agree with you. I don't have child and teenage obesity fully worked out. There are experiments. They're very interesting experiments. There are some middle schools that give kids iPods if they stick certain health criteria. It's very clever. There is a large-scale experiment in Scotland of stopping people randomly, weighing them if they're willing to be weighed, and then giving them prizes if they are, middle school-age kids. I described this at the dinner table, and my 12-year-old immediately suggested vacation in Scotland this summer. So it's possible. Yes?
I wanted to get back to the smoking issue. I think that people who smoke recognize that it's moral things. On the other hand, aren't they really playing the odds? Because the statistics show that 9 out of 10 heavy smokers do not die of cancer or related
So the question is that maybe smoking and obesity, I think also, but lots of things, maybe they're a form of gambling, in a sense, and that people recognize that, you know, not everybody who drives fast gets in a car accident, not everybody who smokes dies young, even though on average you might lose 6 years, to paraphrase the question. People might be taking their chances, and they might think, well, I'll be in the group, maybe it's the majority, that will get away with it, so to speak, and that's a risk I'm willing to take. Well, so it's related to your neighbor's question, so to speak. That's why I carefully tried to preempt you by saying, well, I'm going by the evidence that overwhelming percentage of people who smoke say that they wish they did not smoke. They don't say, oh, it's fun, I like it, and hey, I got a good chance of getting away with it. They say, oh, I am never going to let my kids smoke. I wish I could roll the clock back and not have this addiction. I think that evidence should be taken very seriously. I understand it has problems. If you say to people, do you wish you saved more? It might be that when people say yes, they're saying, well, yeah, I want more money. That is, they might not really be responding to the question. But I don't think that's quite fair. I mean, these questions are framed pretty cleverly. And when people are younger, they don't give the same answers. That is, they give the answer more and more as they get older. Presumably, you'd be happier to be wealthy at age 40 than at age 90. Yet it's at age 90 that people give the stronger answer about how much they wish they had saved, and the same with smoking and so forth. So although I'm suspicious and skeptical and cynical about survey questions in general, I think this stuff deserves to be treated with some respect. I think it's pretty good survey data. So I guess I don't quite agree. I think that they might be gambling, but 85% of them wish they weren't gambling. I think that's pretty strong evidence. But if you're right, there's not much we can do about it. I agree. We could tax the gambling, I suppose. So, I guess table number one might as well just ask the question. Yeah.
Isn't there an exact equivalent in the context of obesity because of the problem you And why should that cost be any different than the cost of second-hand smoke?
That's interesting. I'm going to repeat the question, and at first I thought I had a quick answer to it, but now I realize the question is a little better than it's better than I thought. So I'm going to repeat the question slowly, hoping to come up with an answer while I repeat it. I'm sorry, we don't have time for your question. So Ms. Monkey's question is: wait a minute, not so fast. If secondhand smoke, by the way. We did regulate cigarettes before the secondhand smoke threat. My claim was only, my report of the history was only that the regulation became more dramatic. I mean, there were more bans and more taxes and so forth. But we did tax cigarettes before secondhand smoke. It just was more dramatic. Yes, and we had warnings, ineffective apparently, but many things. But all right. Yeah, barrel. Good. Quit while you're ahead, really. Okay. So the claim is, oh, wait a minute, if secondhand smoke caused people to really increase the taxes on cigarettes, by the way, not to the $40 level I was suggesting they might want, but to the $5 level up from, you know, when I started working on this topic, I had to go to the store to see what cigarettes cost. I mean, do you even notice these ads? And they're on the corner near my house. It was cigarettes, you know, $5.05. This shows you how ignorant we non-smokers are. I thought, well, $5.05 a carton, that doesn't seem so high. I mean, it didn't occur to me that the taxes had become so high that that was a box, you know, a pack of cigarettes. Right, the carton is $50 or something now. And, you know, that is really a lot of taxes, though nothing close to the $35 or $40 a pack that would be suggested by the real health costs you internalize. But secondhand smoke made it worse. So the question is, well, wait a minute. Why won't that happen eventually with obesity? After all, there isn't a convenient interest group like health insurance for reasons I described. And there are only a few people who will occasionally mind the person next to them on the airplane, and they might choose their seats accordingly. But we will all recognize it as taxpayers through Medicaid and Medicare and disability insurance through Social Security. So why won't we rise up as a group and agree to regulation or taxes or whatever it is to try to influence the rate of obesity? So you see how I framed it. My quick answer was going to be, well, we're not a good enough interest group. We're dispersed over many people. But of course, that's not a fair answer because the same is true for the secondhand smoke. It's true that I don't like the secondhand smoke. You puff my way. But I'm tempted to be a free rider. Millions of other people don't like it either. And I might just sit around and, you know, wait for you to ban secondhand smoke or punch people who smoke in public or whatever it is. So if taxpayers in general or interest groups looking for money on their behalf rose up against cigarette smoking because of the secondhand smoke annoyance and costs, then presumably they would do it for obesity. So why don't I predict obesity regulation? I think that's a pretty good argument. If so, there'll be more obesity regulation than we should expect it in, say, 10 or 15 years as these numbers grow. And maybe that's right. So I like that. I will include that in my paper. At the same time, I think I would say maybe there's a little bit of a behind-the-veil problem. When we object to secondhand smoke, we know we're not smokers. By the way, if you're not a smoker, say by age 35, it's extremely unlikely that you become a smoker. Having avoided the addiction up to even age 28 or so, you're really pretty safe. That's not true with obesity. By the way, there's not that good a correlation between child obesity and adult obesity. It's got its own health problems. So maybe that is a little bit of an answer, that it might be that we don't know who they are. We're afraid to tax obesity because the obese people might be ourselves, and we don't know who we are yet, and maybe that makes it a little bit different from smoking. But I need to think about that. I think we have time for one or two more questions. It's the turn of the back first, if somebody wants to be brave in the back. Otherwise, I have no shortage of it. Please.
Could you
Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, I've talked about obesity regulation, meaning taxes, but actually carrots as much as sticks, right? I've talked about rewards and so forth, I mean, regulation writ large. I haven't mentioned litigation. And just as people sue Philip Morris and sue gun manufacturers, why don't I say anything? I mean, what do I think the future is of suits against McDonald's, so to speak? So far, there have been a few of these, well-publicized, but not terribly successful. Maybe these will become successful. Could I comment? Could I make a prediction, I think, is the claim. You know, I have to admit that I'm not a litigation kind of person. I've never sued anyone in my life. I don't really believe in it. I mean, I think many of us feel that. I think many of us feel that way. That is, we're very happy to think about lawsuits and bring them on behalf of other people or defend them. They're an important instrument of social control. But when it comes to our own lives, we want to live life and not spend it bringing or defending lawsuits, and we sort of wish we could be excused from the whole system. Well, I feel that way about, you know, securities regulation as well. I think it's really important, but I'm not reading one of those things. You know, I don't want any part of it. So it's a little bit hard to answer the question without being personal, but I'll try. I don't think that litigation is going to go very far, except for sporadic things. A lot of it is omission, commission kind of stuff. Notice also that there's tremendous food labeling ahead of its time. Cigarette suits started long before labeling, and labeling has proved dramatically inaccurate in many cases, and that's really spurred some of these lawsuits forward after billions of dollars of litigation expenses, literally billions. And, you know, I don't see that with food. I mean, the labeling requirements have been great for a long time. The caloric content has been there for a long time. It appears to be pretty accurate. I mean, there might be some lawsuits about that if they turn out to be inaccurately measured. I don't know if anybody else did this, my eighth grade science project, which did not win, I might add, was to try to burn things and show that you could figure out how many calories, were in a potato chip. This turns out to be very, very hard to do and did burn down my uncle's couch. I might add. So you might want to be careful. But it actually is a very difficult science, this measuring of calories, and I can imagine some lawsuits about that. But I just think, you know, it's really stacked the other way, so to speak. I mean, you can imagine lawsuits against diet companies, against exercise. There's no shortage of people to sue. The question is, what will work? It's really a little bit harder for me to imagine. But it's possible. I think it could happen, but I wouldn't predict it. So one more, and then I think we're done. And I'd be happy to take questions by email or afterwards.
I suppose the opposite of obesity regulation would be an expansion of the civil rights statutes, where obesity is a protected class, which I think San Francisco has already done by municipal ordinance. Do you think that's more likely, and if that happens, what effect do you think that would have on your predicted rise of private-contractual relationships dealing with obesity?
Yes, I was going to raise, I'll repeat the question, I was going to raise that in response to the airline issue. The opposite of obesity regulation, the claim is, though I don't really think it's the opposite, but the claim is the opposite might be, rather than taxing or regulating obesity, it might be putting obesity on a pedestal by attaching it to civil rights protection so that it would be a protected class. Not just that airlines couldn't require obese people to buy two seats, but maybe that it would be regarded as pernicious to tax things related to obesity or to regulate obesity and so forth, and maybe that's possible. There is evidence, right, that obese people are discriminated against in interviews and job applications and so forth. Very good evidence, actually, especially for women. The evidence is really kind of stunning. again, that's not my area of law, therefore why not make a prediction and all that. By the way, I don't see that the two are inconsistent. I can imagine that it becomes even more illegal than it is now through ADA and other law. I can imagine it being quite dangerous to discriminate against an obese person in employment. That is a strong regulation. But at the same time, using carrots and sticks to try to discourage obesity. Again, remember, 85 to 90% of people who are obese will vote in favor of such rules, especially if some of them are in the form of rewards. That is, that's the lobbying group. You know, most... You know, look around the room, but make believe you're not doing it because it's politically incorrect. I mean, most people who are in great shape, you know, regard the subject as a little boring. You know, obesity regulation, who cares? You know, it's mostly people who are fighting weight problems that are, in a sense, looking for regulation. They don't want it to be overly intrusive. You know, they don't want weighings in the public square. But they might not mind a system that combined a little bit of penalty and a little bit of reward and so on. I wouldn't. I would like it, actually. So I'm not sure that that group would object to it that much. So I think, yes, we do and we will find more protection in the employment place, but I don't think that will really affect. It's a lot like retirement. There might be really good protection for you if you're a poor person, but that doesn't mean there's nothing inconsistent with that and the idea that we will try to encourage you through the tax system to save more. I think the two can run together. So many of you have to get back to work. As I always say, it's in the law school's interest for you to get back to work. Thank you very, very much for coming. I'm sorry for the questions I didn't get to. I'd be happy to take them now. Thank you very much.